Hi, Kerry Crucial Brothers. When Alicia returned from Egypt, she wanted a fresh start in every area of her life. I told my friend Nick that I wanted to begin pricing engagement rings, but by then, things were already shifting with Alicia and me. I've taken so long to propose because I was waiting for the perfect moment. I wanted to have things in place, like a certain amount of money to bring to the table, you know, to show I was worthy. As a man who'd been resourceful from a young age, I never wanted to ride her coattails. I think she sensed the proposal was coming. She told me, let's go back to dating again. For a while, we lived in separate rooms in the house. Maybe she felt, if I'm going to possibly be with this man for the rest of my life, I need to be sure. We tried the dating thing, but we eventually ended our relationship before I got to propose. In hindsight, the whole reason we might have been in each other's lives was for the songs to come through us. That couldn't have happened in the way that it did if we weren't so close. Maybe we were brought together for the specific purpose to make music history.
Most of us take about 16 breaths per minute. That means we typically breathe 960 times an hour, or around 23,000 times a day. During my two glorious weeks of silence, I had more than 322,000 opportunities to breathe my way into a new existence. One exhale at a time, I let go of the urge to twist myself into a pretzel, trying to live up to others' expectations. I let go of the belief that if I stepped away, nothing would be there when I returned. And in place of that notion, I inhaled liberation. I inhaled the boundlessness and brilliance that once guided the Egyptians in crafting monuments of greatness. That's what 14 days of solitude can bring. Space to breathe. Time to reflect. A chance to reimagine what your life can look like. When freedom tapped me on my shoulder, I answered loud and strong. Back in New York, my team immediately noticed a shift in me. I need 2 weeks to myself before and after every tour, I announced. And when ahead of a press day in Japan, my manager showed me the proposed schedule, one crammed with wall-to-wall interviews, I pushed back. I'll need a 15-minute break after every hour to keep from turning into a robot, I said. I began using the single most powerful word a pleaser can ever speak. No. It took practice. When pleasing has become your MO, it's tough to consistently begin holding your boundaries. But it gets easier the more you do it. You start to realize that the earth doesn't fall off its axis because you turned down a speaking engagement or even a movie role. The world keeps right on spinning. And the gift you give yourself is more energy to do the work you actually want to be doing. Saying no doesn't make you less of an artist or human being. It makes you a stronger and more purposeful one. My new spirit also showed up during studio sessions. I'd already been creating in the airspace of full expression, but after Egypt, I removed all safety nets and opened myself up to different ways of collaborating. I'd been so inspired by the pentatonic scale that I began implementing that sound. I even brought in sitarists to play the ancient instrument and compose with me. The songs we wrote never made it onto the next album, but they marked the start of my exploration. My desire for playfulness and newness. My intention to both color outside the musical lines and build my very own crayon box. On my first two studio albums, I'd mostly written with Kerry. I'd always felt nervous about composing with others because the process is so vulnerable. You're sharing your greatest insecurities with someone when you write a song with them. You're revealing the most sensitive parts of who you are because that is the only way to make the lyrics feel authentic. After Egypt, I felt brave enough to try writing with others. I connected with Linda Perry, the prolific songwriter and former lead singer of Four Non Blondes. She has created epic songs for artists like Christina Aguilera, Adele, Pink, and Gwen Stefani. When we first sat down together side by side at the Baby Grand, I was scared to expose myself. But Linda was so open, so secure in her space while being tender with mine, that I quickly felt comfortable enough to peel back the layers. She encouraged me to create by blurting out stream-of-consciousness-style phrases that didn't always seem to make sense, but that expressed feelings under the surface. And when my subconscious spoke, we flowed with it. The unvarnished truth comes through on Sure Looks Good to Me, one of the songs we wrote together. Life is cheap, bittersweet, but it tastes good to me. Take my turn, crash and burn, it's how it's supposed to be. In every crack and tremble in my voice, you can hear the rawness. Linda also worked with me on Superwoman. Steve Mauston, another great songwriter and musician who'd played with me on tour, and I had already started the song. All three of us were part of creating the song. Even when I'm a mess, I still put on a vest with an S on my chest. Oh yes, I'm a superwoman. Before that song, I'd never publicly acknowledged that I can be a mess. But post-Egypt, it was time. Linda, Steve, and I started with that chorus and built the full song from there. I wrote Superwoman not because I felt like one. The lyrics were what I needed to hear. Words that affirmed that, even in my brokenness, there is strength. As I Am, my third album, is a blend of bold tempos and musical textures, each reflecting my experimental zone. When I listen to the album now, I hear the funkadelic sounds of the clavinet and the strum of the harpsichord. I hear the 60s influences alive and reverberating on Teenage Love Affair. I hear my voice tinged with emotion on Tell You Something, my tribute to Nana. On the lead single No One, I hear the fever pitch of the Jupiter, the vintage keyboard, and on the album's cover, I see my face on full display, up close and intimate with the world. I also see a gang of hair flowing down my back, which is prominent on the front of the Superwoman single as well. The white t-shirt and door knockers are so me, but those layers of long locks blown back by the wind from a fan brought in during the photo shoot were a step toward a girly look. On my second album, Diary, I'd edged in that direction a tiny bit, trading 24/7 cornrows for hair braided in the front but down in the back. And alongside As I Am's deeply honest lyrics, there is another small pivot, from hippie hood to hippie glam. At my core, I'm still myself, just exploring and experimenting with how to express that truth visually. Losing Nana had given Craig and me something in common: grief. He was a heartbroken son. I was a devastated granddaughter. Our shared sorrow served as a gale force, pushing us toward each other even amid our tensions. During those months when Nana struggled through her chemo, I'd witnessed a side of Craig I hadn't seen. He sat near the edge of Nana's bed, his voice soft, his tenderness apparent as he stroked his mother's hair and spoke words of comfort. In those moments, I saw Craig not as the father who let me down, but as the child of a woman he loved deeply. His obvious care for Nana softened me. It also paved the way for a conversation we had soon after her passing. For 11 years, I'd put Craig on mute. In fact, even before then, I'd never asked him to tell me his story or to explain how he and my mother's paths had crossed. One evening, with the shadows of dusk settling over my neighborhood, we walked side by side. I listened quietly as he explained to me, for the first time, what he'd experienced. He and my mother had been lovers, yes, but not in love with each other. I'd been conceived in an act of passion, a rush of desire that resulted in the unexpected. By the time my mother told Craig she was pregnant, she'd decided she was keeping me. Craig, who had no say in this huge life choice Mom had already made, was simply not ready to opt into fatherhood. I realized that probably left him with some difficult questions. Where do I fit into this scenario? How do I express what I'm feeling to this strong-headed Taurian woman? And how do I connect with a child I never intended to have? As Craig shared his perspective, it rang true. And during my childhood and beyond, it was this very narrative that had filled me with such resentment. What's crazy is, while the poison of anger was corroding my insides, Craig seemed oblivious. On the other side of the country, he carried on with his life and other family while I stewed in my misery. I wasted so much energy nursing my bitterness, trying to get back at him and hoping he'd experience as much heartache as I had. But the whole time, I was the one hurting. I was the one who, by living in that negative energy, drew even more of it to myself. It was so backward. That night, as Craig spoke, I came to a realization. He did not have to be my daddy. He could just be Craig. The years he'd missed were already in our rearview mirrors. Right there, in the present, we could get to know each other not as father and daughter, but as two adults. All my life, I'd been carrying around this notion of who Craig should have been for me, the doting father who showed up, the dad who read me stories at bedtime or cheered me on at my piano recitals. It was normal for me to want those things. Most kids do. But that just wasn't our situation. And it dawned on me, more than a decade after I ended my communication with him, that looking back wouldn't change a thing between us. I could not rewrite our complicated story, but what I could do was create an entirely new one. "Can we start from this point on?" I asked him. The question itself, like Craig's nod of agreement, marked a pivot. The pause of a comma in place of my letter's final punctuation mark. An aha moment is not a happy ending. It is an open doorway, one you have to choose to walk through. After the lights came on for me, I didn't suddenly set aside all my hard feelings. That's not the way it happens in real life. But the conversation gave Craig and me a new place to enter. And on the other side of that entryway, we discovered that there was a lot more work to do. That work is still being done. It was a complicated time for Carrie and me after my first few albums took off. He worked hard on great music behind the scenes, only to later just get a small slice of the affirmation that I regularly received. That dynamic, that inequality in our experiences, swayed our relationship off balance. Even for someone as laid back as Carrie, the lack of acknowledgement had to be rough. Yes, being listed in the credits of my album brought him satisfaction. But like any ambitious and talented artist would, he longed to be recognized for all of what he brought to the table. Yet Carrie's contributions were often overlooked. We'd be out celebrating at an industry gathering when someone who'd already met him 15 times would ask him, "What's your name again?" I would then feel badly and try to compensate. I wanted him to be seen as equal, to feel validated. "You know my partner Crucial, right?" I try to say when others approached us. On the occasions when I didn't introduce him because the moment just wasn't right, he'd notice. Later, at home, he'd sometimes mention it. It was an awkward situation made worse by the fact that I was anxious about being judged. I was still Baby Keys, the new artist with a strong urge to bolt whenever I heard my own music over the loudspeakers at an industry party. I'd find myself standing nervously across from a heavyweight in the business, struggling to hold my own while pretending I knew more than I did. And in that headspace, I wasn't always focused on making sure Carrie was recognized. Our extended separations added another level of stress. For months while I was touring, we lived apart and lost some of the intimacy that only an in-person connection can bring. Though Carrie visited, he wasn't able to drop his whole life to stay with me on the road. So in our Long Island studio, he spent countless hours writing and producing while I was gone. He also guided the artists on our production label, Crucial Keys. That became his own challenge as we'd taken on more than we could handle with our team. Every one of our artists was so brand new. In a way, we all were. Carrie and I were like the blind leading the beginners, and over time, that got heavy. Our goal had been to provide all these different artists, most of them our dear friends, with a creative outlet. But as we learned, it takes an enormous amount of energy and investment to launch an artist. They each put in serious effort, but still couldn't get much traction. And the only work that seemed to be producing any financial gain was our collaboration on my albums. It was both overwhelming and unsustainable. Meanwhile, Kerry was experiencing some success with writing and producing his own music. In 2001, he'd locked down a publishing deal with Broadcast Music Inc., BMI, as well as composed and produced music for the soundtracks of Dr. Dolittle, Shaft, Drumline, and Ali. He also set up Crucial Noise, his own production company, and earned strong royalties through that brand. When it came to his independent releases, Kerry was always driven to create his own music. He definitely established a following. And yet the music didn't have quite as much commercial impact as we'd both hoped. That lit an even stronger fire under him, and around 2006, he began working around the clock on his material. During late-night studio sessions that stretched to sunrise, he and his crew would be in the studio banging out beats and trying to lift their creations to the next level. That's around the time he found himself drinking a little too much. Kerry would typically have a beer during his studio sessions, but over time, that once-in-a-while beer turned into a daily habit as he dealt with our extended separation, helping others in their careers, and the difficulties that come with the creative process. The liquor seemed to loosen his tongue. Kerry was ordinarily kind, complimentary, cool, but when he drank, he was, at times, belittling. He never raised a hand to me, not once, but he could get loud. In one session when we were collaborating with some other artists, he talked over me, implying that I didn't know what I was doing. I excused it. In those days, I was an expert at playing down or ignoring conduct that I should have spoken on directly. "Nah, he didn't mean it like that," I said to Jeff when my manager later asked me about the incident. I knew Kerry was drunk. I also knew there was alcoholism in his family. But instead of immediately saying to him, "I never want you to speak to me that way again," I tried to calm the situation by minimizing his behavior. In 2006, while I was on the road, Kerry called my cell. "I just got in a bad car accident," he said, breathing heavily into the phone. I froze. "Are you okay?" I asked. He was. And though thankfully no one was hurt during the incident, his Escalade was totaled. He'd been driving home that morning after spending the whole night in the studio, creating and drinking over the course of the evening. It scared me that he'd let his habit go far enough to put his life in danger. Our relationship, which was already strained, deteriorated from there. I retreated to the patterns I'd had in place from the beginning of our time together. I didn't communicate my frustrations. I played the same record I'd played throughout my childhood, staying silent and pulling back in an attempt to keep things cool. When you don't speak the truth for years at a time, the words left unspoken slowly leak the air out of your connection. Even if years later you are ready to say what you couldn't earlier, the moment has passed. The details and circumstances have faded from memory, and yet the emotions linger. And then the day finally comes when you no longer recognize the person you first loved. That day came for me at some point in 2006, around the time I slid into depression over Nana's condition. Kerry and I were still together, but I'd never felt more disconnected from him. "Who are you? And who am I?" I'd often stare at him and think. I realized Kerry was looking at rings. I can't recall whether he told me that or if it was just in the ether. Whatever the case, it made me nervous. Not just because our relationship was already on shaky ground, but also because I wasn't sure I ever wanted to get married. I definitely was not a girl who'd always dreamed of a fairy tale wedding. And at 26, I wasn't ready to make such a big commitment. "I don't want any diamonds," I said to Kerry one evening. Blood diamonds were used to finance war and oppress the poor, and I wanted no part in it. But that's not the only reason I mentioned it to Kerry. Rather, it was my backdoor way of telling him, "Don't bring me an engagement ring." I eventually told Kerry I needed space so we could begin again, and we started sleeping in separate rooms. I had hoped that by backing away, I could rediscover with fresh eyes all the incredible things that first drew us together. We were both holding on to the amazing memories and music we'd created, as well as the space of comfort and familiarity we shared for so many years. But I felt clear that I needed to transition. One evening that fall, sitting across from Carrie on a couch at my mother's house, we ended things. With the passing of time comes perspective. And from where I stand now, more than a decade after Carrie and I moved in different directions, I deeply cherish and acknowledge our relationship for what it was, a safe space to experience love and music. It was also yet another opportunity to see myself in full, a chance to recognize all those places in me that still needed to grow, all the ways in which I'd swallowed my truth rather than voicing it. We don't draw loved ones into our lives coincidentally. They're there to shine a light on our unfinished emotional business, to reveal to us our deepest tendencies. And as my life has proven to me even now, those patterns appear time and again, often cleverly disguised. And they'll keep right on showing up until we're willing to truly look at them. In November 2007, As I Am debuted at the top of the charts, making it my fourth consecutive number one release. Fans, or my fam, as I call them now, were still embracing my music with wide open arms. In its first week, the album sold 742,000 copies, the highest for any female R&B artist. The lead single, No One, also secured the top spot on the charts and became that year's most listened to song. As I Am ultimately went triple platinum and earned me 3 more Grammys. I'd established myself as a musician with lasting momentum, and it felt unbelievably amazing. I'm often asked which one of my albums is my favorite, which is like asking a mother which one of her children she most adores. Even if she has a clear preference, she'll never admit it. For me, As I Am will always be one of my top 3 most beloved albums, mainly because of the season in my life that it reminds me of. While writing those songs, I was just beginning to discover my true self. Before then, my life had been kicking and screaming, trying to get my full attention. And on a deck, drifting down the Nile, I finally tuned in and took inventory. Once home, ready to work on As I Am, I had cleared my voice and my space, creating room for a miracle I couldn't have known was coming. Chapter 10, Sunflower.
Hello, this is Kasim Dean, aka Swiss Beats. Also Grammy Award-winning super producer, they call me sometimes, co-founder of the Dean Collection, and Alicia's soulmate. In the beginning, Alicia thought I was super obnoxious, because I was. I was so obnoxious that I couldn't even talk to myself. I was in Rough Rider mode, part of that whole aggressive DMX hip-hop scene, filled with Rolls Royces, diamonds, gold watches. The excess was a way to celebrate finally getting some artistic freedom. But all of that flash didn't resonate with Alicia, who has never been about material things. Years later, we started getting to know each other. Our conversation got real unpredictable, real fast. And that's when she realized that there was more to me than the cars and the jewelry. I wasn't just popping bottles and collecting Ferraris, trying to feel important or compete with my crew. I was sleeping on the floor in the studio, completely focused on making music history.
It's crazy how long Swiss and I have known each other. He was 16 when we first met, which meant I was about 14. Nikki, my friend and an MC, went to school with him. "Yo, you gotta meet Swiss," she kept saying. "He's doing his music thing, you're doing yours, and y'all should work together." One afternoon, we stopped by the school they both attended, Truman High in the Bronx. As Swiss now recalls, I was standing out front rocking a purple puffy jacket, looking tomboyish but still kind of cute. We talked for a minute about nothing deep, and then as I walked off, he asked if we could exchange numbers. I was like, nah, I'm good. I'll just see you when I see you. And see him around, I did. In 1998, rapper DMX stormed onto the scene with his first album, It's Dark and Hell is Hot, which was on the Rough Riders label. Swiss, who worked with that label alongside his uncles who owned it with Swiss's aunt, created the iconic beat for Rough Riders Anthem, which became DMX's number one hit single. Once that album exploded, we ended up in the same circles at various award shows and industry events. He'd usually pull up in some fancy car, rolling deep with his Bronx crew and shining with diamonds. He couldn't just have on one fresh chain. He had to have five of them. I wasn't feeling the vibe. It was so ostentatious, so over the top, and I wanted nothing to do with that scene or with Swiss. Years later, I read an article Swiss had been interviewed for. In it, he claimed he could create a beat in 10 minutes. So annoying. Why would somebody be bragging about producing music that fast? I said to Jeff. What I'm doing is real music, I thought. You're supposed to craft it from scratch, take your time with it, and really care about it. I was so friggin' righteous then. And after that story, I was even more turned off by Swiss. Fast forward to when I was wrapping up some new music I'd been working on. I was feeling creatively burned out after months of poring over it. Why don't we bring in Swiss for a collaboration, Jeff suggested. It would add another flavor to the album. Even before he could get the last sentence out of his mouth, I stopped him. Not only did I refuse to work with another artist on the tail end of partnering with a whole series of them, I told Jeff, I also had zero interest in teaming up with Swiss, the self-proclaimed 10-minute beatmaster. I liked his music well enough to dance to it, but I couldn't see how we'd ever be a good match in the studio. It's cool if you all want to work with him, Jeff told me, but why don't you just meet him? There's no commitment. I reluctantly agreed. Swiss was finishing up his own session when I arrived at the studio. Hey, what's up? He asked. I'm cool, I said, in a tone that made it apparent I'd rather be anyplace else. Hey, look, he said, glancing down at his shirt and then over at mine. We're both wearing yellow. Eye roll. We chatted briefly, but didn't work on any particular song that day. We just hung out and talked to see how things flowed. And despite my funky attitude at the start, it turned out to be cool. By the time we parted, he'd moved up half an inch in my book, from totally irritating to only slightly annoying and actually a bit funny. A few weeks later, our managers set up another studio session. When the day rolled around, Swiss flaked at the last minute, and my bad attitude came rushing back. Once he did arrive at the studio, I was working on a song. Whatever you're doing in here, he said, keep doing it. There's some magic happening in this room. I thanked him, and he left to go to another room we'd work in as I stayed and finished the vocals. Later, when we began experimenting with some beats and lyrics, the energy was incredible. I found myself laughing and enjoying the process. He was definitely in his zone, opening himself up to the music without overthinking it and just allowing the vibe to carry him. That's how he flows. It's also how, as I saw for myself that afternoon, he could create so quickly. Next thing I knew, we'd written a whole song using this sick house beat juxtaposed with my piano playing. And you won't believe how long it took us to put it together. About 10 minutes. My bad. The more we talked, the more I noticed how his mind worked. He clearly didn't fit the stereotype of the rapper who was only about diamond medallions and showboating. Outwardly, he seemed to be all those things. But beyond the baggy jeans and the arm tats, there was depth. He once casually mentioned, for instance, that he'd bought his first Ansel Adams photograph when he was just 18. And he was so aware of what was happening in the world, so curious about not just art and music, but also about business and entrepreneurship and current events. Interesting. Can we grab something to eat? He asked me one afternoon. We were becoming friends, but I politely declined. He was cool and everything, but I'd never been busier. With my crazy schedule, getting together was out of the question. Well, you gotta eat, don't you? He said. What about just a lunch? I finally agreed, on the condition that I'd only be able to take a 45-minute break from a photo shoot I was doing. I made a reservation for noon at an outdoor restaurant in downtown Manhattan, a place close to my set location. I arrived at 12 on a dot. Swiss was nowhere in sight. 15 minutes later, I was still on that patio waiting and asking myself, why did I set myself up for this foolishness? My schedule was crazy, and one late moment led to a whole day off track. When he finally came strutting in at 12:20 p.m., I was in no mood for an excuse. He tried to hug me, but I brushed him off. While apologizing profusely, he handed me a bag. I opened it and lifted out a pair of sunglasses. You're late, and you're giving me Louis Vuitton glasses? I complained. He grinned, which cooled things off just long enough for him to sit. As he did, I looked more closely at the bag. On its front was a beautiful art replica. Wow, who did that piece? I asked. That's Erte, he said matter-of-factly. Who? I said. Erte, the French artist, he said. You don't know Erte? I don't, I said, studying the image, but I like the bag better than the glasses. Well, I'm going to introduce you to Erte, he said. His work is phenomenal. I shrugged and set the bag aside, still feeling annoyed. We put in an order and began talking, and as much as I wanted to stay mad at Swiss, he lifted the mood with a steady stream of humor and fascinating conversation. Even before we'd finished our meal, I rose to leave, reminding him I had to get back to my photo shoot. He insisted that he walk me out. As we approached my car, I noticed something enormous attached to its top. What's that? I said, walking closer. He smiled. That's why I was late, he said. Swiss lowered the large item, removed the big bow tied around it, and held it up to reveal a painting of a grand piano with paintbrushes attached to the keys. When I saw this, he explained, it seemed like the perfect representation of our friendship. You're the keys, I'm the brushes. When he'd purchased it from a street vendor a few days earlier, he explained, he planned to give it to me. But in order to prop it up on my car roof, he had to arrive at the restaurant after me so that my car would already be there. It was such a nice gesture. To this day, Swiss is generous like that. If he meets a budding photographer and has a camera on him, he'll hand over the camera on the spot. And he brings thoughtful gifts to those he has just met all the time to make them feel special. That's his style. I tried to play it cool, but I was impressed. And yet nothing in me suggested this would be anything more than a friendship. So I thanked him for the painting, and we moved on. We ran into each other off and on, and every time we connected, we realized how similar our stories were. We'd each been successful at a young age. We were creators of our own sound and lyrics, and we each shouldered major financial responsibility in our families. Stylistically, he and I couldn't have been more different. Yet when it came to our experiences, we were kindred spirits. And each time the universe brought us face to face, an ease and understanding surrounded our conversations. Even still, we didn't connect much. He was traveling, I was traveling. We were just living our own lives with little time for anything else. One evening, Swiss invited me to dinner and a surprise. I accepted. Just meet me after you're done with your day and we'll go from there, he told me. He met me downtown at a building that from the outside looked closed. But when we stepped through the front door, I entered a brave new world of art. A gallery filled with some of the most exquisite paintings I'd ever seen. With the help of his longtime friend David Rogath, an art connoisseur and the gallery's owner, Swiss had flown in from France an entire collection of Erte pieces. He'd also arranged for David to close the gallery just so Swiss could give me a private tour. "I told you I'd introduce you to Erte," he said. I couldn't believe it. As I wandered, wide-eyed and stunned, through the gallery, Swiss walked at my side explaining every painting, from the year the work had been completed to its artistic and historical significance. He was so knowledgeable, not just about Erte, the father of Art Deco, but also about the dozens of master artists whose names he referenced with such ease, from Chagall and Dali to Basquiat and Warhol. As he spoke, his eyes danced with childlike delight. I'd realized months earlier that he had more than a passing interest in art. But his deep awareness of the art world proved he was as much a student of the subject as he was an avid collector. At the end of the tour, we rounded the corner into a room with a gorgeous candlelit table already set for two. Swiss knew I didn't eat meat, so he'd brought in a chef who'd prepared a scrumptious vegetarian meal. It was the most special thing anyone had ever done for me. The Erte surprise stirred something in me I'd never known was there. Is this real? What does it mean? And where do we go from here? Over dinner that evening, we spoke openly about what was happening between us. The magnetism was so unbelievably strong that neither of us could dismiss it. I've never experienced that kind of pull toward another human being. As I was preparing to leave on another tour, Swiss and I went out for Japanese food. He paid for dinner, but for some crazy reason, he got home later and found my credit card in his pocket. He called and told me that. "There's no way you have my card because I never took it out of my purse," I said. But sure enough, the card was mine. "Damn, I'm gonna need that card when I'm on the road," I said. "Can I pick it up from you at the studio tomorrow?" He agreed. The next evening when I arrived, Swiss met me out front and handed me the card. I had an hour to spare, so we decided to hang out a little more before I left town. "Take us someplace quiet," I said to the driver, who was new. He drove us to Battery Park, to the very spot where Swiss and I had often met up. We walked and talked about what the future might hold for us, and right there on our path was a book turned upside down. I knelt and picked it up. It was called Old Turtle and the Broken Truth, a children's story about a truth that once fell from the sky. As it fell, one half blazed through the atmosphere while the other half tumbled to the ground. Someone found the fallen piece and kept it only for his tribe. Wars broke out among the tribes about who would own the truth. In the end, they discovered that their broken truth fit together with its other half to form a golden heart. And only once those halves were rejoined could there be peace. After reading the story, Swiss and I stared at each other, flabbergasted. It felt like a sign. As we were walking out of the park, we noticed on the sidewalk a children's chalk drawing of some large sunflowers. "Sunflower is the nickname Swiss had given me. Your energy is so bright," he'd say. The drawing, the book, the credit card, each, it seemed, was providence pulling us toward each other. As we left the park that evening, the sun descending over the Hudson, we both recognized the truth. The magic between us was so powerful, so undeniable, that we knew we were meant to be together. A few months after Swiss and I had been together, it was my turn to do something special for him. I brought together four of his biggest passions: art, fast cars, Louis Vuitton, and music. I told him to dress up, but offered no other clues. "Just meet me at 7 p.m., I said. I'm sure he thought I was planning a nice dinner out. When he showed up, dapper and excited, I said, "I've got a little surprise for you." It actually wasn't so little. The Louis Vuitton store in New York City is on 57th Street and 5th. Swiss stopped by the store so frequently, like he was dropping in for a quart of milk, we began jokingly calling it the bodega. Ahead of the celebration, I got in touch with the managers and arranged to rent the entire store. And on that evening, I ushered him into the front door of the bodega, which had been transformed into a dining room for a private party. A master chef prepared a delicious meal, a difficult feat because there was no kitchen on the premises. Swiss's grandmother was there, his parents were there, some of his aunts and uncles and close friends even flew in to join us. Dinner was just the beginning. Swiss had always been a big fan of the Gumball 3000, an event in which drivers race fancy cars thousands of miles across Europe and other continents. Swiss talked about it nonstop. I rented a slew of high-end cars, and when we exited the Vuitton store, the line of vehicles from Lamborghinis to Porsches, and with enough room for every guest, awaited. Our destination? The Guggenheim on the Upper East Side. Swiss cut over to Madison Avenue and sped uptown in his Porsche, an enormous grin on his face the whole way. Once we arrived at the museum, which we had to ourselves, we partied to the beats of Angelique Kidjo, an African artist and dear friend of mine. He was floored, maybe even more shocked than I'd been on the evening of the Erte surprise. And he couldn't believe I'd been able to pull off such a big event without him ever having an inkling of it. I have his friends and family, the co-conspirators I'd enlisted, to thank for that. For years before I met Swiss, I never understood the old cliche, you just know when you know. How can you ever be sure that you're destined to be with someone? Only after crossing paths with Swiss did I grasp the truth in that saying. A soulmate connection isn't just an awareness. It's a deep sense of knowing, a wave of intuition that permeates your every pore. All the cells in your body rise up on their tiptoes. You don't see this feeling coming. You can't prepare for it. You might even try to push it away, as I did. And yet it always surges back, each time with greater force, sweeping you up in its mighty current, thrusting you toward a beautiful shore, unknown. Chapter 11, Empire. Let me start this chapter off with some words from my friend and creative collaborator, Jay-Z.
I got a call one weekend from a music publisher, John Platt, also known as Big John because he's like 6'7". He had this song by two writers, Angela Hunt and Janet Sewell Ulepick. He played it for me and I was like, I'm ready to do it. Send me the files. I took off the verses and added my own, but kept the chorus. When it was done, I listened back and I knew it was going to be special. You get those feelings. Sometimes you're wrong, but I knew this song was going to be impactful. For the chorus, I thought, who embodies New York? Mary J. Blige came to mind first, but there was something about the piano part that made me feel like it had to be Alicia. I kept pitching her in her braids, playing those piano stabs. So I reached out to her and I start overselling it. This is going to be the biggest record about New York since Sinatra's, I told her. After she heard it, she was like, cool, let's do it. When I heard her vocals, something was a bit off. Her full swagger wasn't there, and I wanted those little ad-libs that she does. I can be a little OCD, so it bothered me a little. But I'm reluctant to make a call like that, especially with people I'm fond of. I drank some water and thought, here goes nothing. When I asked her to do it over, there was an awkward silence for about 3 seconds. She was like, huh? But then she recorded it again and even wrote that beautiful bridge. Put your lighters in the air, everybody say, yeah. Which took the song to another level. I recently performed Empire in South Africa for Global Citizens Festival. From the stage, I looked to my right and there stood Big John, the guy who brought me the song, with the biggest smile on his face. It was a perfect full circle moment, and it was Alicia's bridge that tore the roof off the stadium that night. Empire was on my album called Blueprint 3. My original idea for the album was to go all around the world and produce different sounds like Paul Simon did with Graceland. It was going to be this global album. What's crazy is a song about my hometown ended up being the biggest song worldwide that I've ever made. That's why I believe in the power of intention. My intention was to have a global album. And even though that didn't happen exactly the way I initially thought it would, the universe heard my intention and delivered on it.
Empire State of Mind almost didn't happen for me. In early 2009, when Jay-Z suggested that we get together on a song in tribute to our hometown, his idea never made it around to my ears. For weeks, Jay had been reaching out to my manager about the collaboration, and when that went nowhere, he nearly gave up and called on another artist. "But I kept feeling like you were the right person to do it," he said, "because you're from New York and you get the whole vibe," which is why he finally dialed me up directly. Jeff had been my gatekeeper from day one. Everything related to my career flowed through him. When songs in A minor took off and my world suddenly spun out of control, I loved having Jeff on the front lines. It brought me an older brother kind of comfort, one I appreciated since I was still so young. I felt protected and taken care of, like someone had my back while also keeping an eye on the front door. But as I grew into myself, both as an artist and a woman, I started realizing that was way too much power to hand over to another person, even to someone as trustworthy as Jeff. All those who wanted to reach me had to contact Jeff first, and he then got to decide whether I should hear about a pitch or a project. I don't know why, but Jeff didn't mention Jay's idea. In the studio, Jay played me the bones of the song. "Please call Jay's team and tell him I'm for sure doing the song," I told Jeff soon after. Right away, Jay and I began trying to sync up our schedules to record in the same studio, but given our crazy calendars, we couldn't make it happen quickly. Meanwhile, I came down with a cold. Jay, who was on a tight deadline to finish the song for his 11th studio album, suggested that I do my part on my own. So I recorded the first version of my vocals in an LA studio and sent it to him. He called me after he heard it. "Hey, A," he said, "thanks for the vocals. But, can you record it again?" Silence. "Huh?" I said, laughing. "You mean you want me to do the whole thing over?" "Yeah," he said. "I just think you could cut that one a little better." I couldn't argue. My head cold was so bad that while I was recording, I worked my way through a whole box of Kleenex. "And you know how you always do that ad-lib talking in your songs?" he said. "I need you to do some of that on here." Once my cold had passed, I recorded the second cut in my Long Island studio. Jay seemed thrilled with it. My vocals were added to the full song, and we were both excited about the sound. "Do you think it's too New York?" he asked me. I paused. "Yeah, it's pretty New York," I said, "but I think that's cool." Jay wondered whether listeners would get it, whether the lyrics were so tied to the life in our city that it wouldn't resonate with anyone who wasn't from here. He didn't change the song. He simply asked the question. The world answered in unison after we released our ode to the City of Dreams that October. Empire topped the charts for 5 consecutive weeks. It roared across multiple continents, pushing past language barriers and joining Frank Sinatra's 1979 rendition of New York, New York as one of the city's best-loved anthems. In fact, it was such a potent force that it crushed all music in its path, including my own. Radio DJs were already given so much airtime to Empire that 2 of the singles I put out ahead of my 5th album, The Element of Freedom, weren't getting as many spins. That's when we came up with the idea of creating my own broken-down take on the song, with me at the piano singing all the verses. That move allowed me to perform my version on any stage around the world, and Jay didn't have to be there to rhyme. It also appealed to a wide radio listenership that extended beyond hip-hop. To this day, Empire State of Mind Part 2 is one of my all-time biggest-selling records. The following year, during the Element of Freedom tour, I performed in Paris. I stood backstage thinking, is Empire going to make sense to this audience? Will it translate? Man, did it. From the opening note to the final verse, those beautiful French people stayed up on their feet and sang every single word. They belted out the lyrics at the top of their lungs, nailing each turn and nuance. It was so visceral, so passionate, and so on point that I didn't even have to open my mouth. They performed the song for me as their energy soared up from the seats and filled the air above. That happened time and again in my later tours, in Brussels, Berlin, and Barcelona, in Lisbon and Zurich, in Tokyo and Sydney, in Kuala Lumpur and Manila. When 30,000 people are stamping their feet singing along to songs you've helped create, the complete awe and spine-tingling energy of that experience never gets old. It is more than just a concert. It's a spiritual communion, a bright, pulsating vibration that lifts everyone in its presence. After that Paris performance, I had an epiphany. Empire isn't just about New York. It's about hope. No matter where you're from, we all want the opportunity to work hard and breathe life into our ambitions. My hometown, more than any other city, represents that possibility. Millions have arrived on New York shores, inspired by the sight of Lady Liberty, her torch lighting the way for dreamers. This city will always be the port of entry for risers and idealists, a place where potential dances in the streets and wafts through the air. A place where the seemingly impossible feels worth attempting. And that feeling isn't just about a location. It's about aspiration, embedded in the human spirit, transcending all geographical barriers. No one could have predicted that Empire would become the kind of worldwide phenomenon that it did. Artists often think we know what songs will strike a chord as we work in a studio, but no one can ever be sure. When a song becomes part of the culture in the way that Empire has, there are so many factors involved. No promotional plan can bring that about. It cannot be recreated because it's a mystery. And when it occurs, all you can do is enjoy the miracle even as you give thanks for it. Bliss is a beautiful destination, but you can often only reach its shores after a turning point. It's as if the universe is testing you to be sure you are strong enough to make it through the murky waters, not just the serene ones, so that you can move to a new and unknown place in yourself. In 2009, life sent me exactly such a transition. The year began on a high note, with Barack Obama becoming president. On that brisk January morning, our nation's first Black commander-in-chief placed his palm on Lincoln's Bible while Michelle, graceful and resplendent in that gorgeous Isabel Toledo dress and coat outfit, looked on with enormous pride. As I watched from the stands, I felt honored to be seated next to civil rights activist Ralph Abernathy, one of the many brave pioneers who marched and fought to make possible the moment we were standing in. Anticipation echoed from the steps of the Lincoln Memorial to the top of the Washington Monument, reverberating through the millions who'd gathered to witness history unfold. Following the ceremony, the only thing left to do was party. I had the privilege of performing No One at our new president's inaugural ball. Then, following Beyoncé's rapturous rendition of At Last, Mary J. Blige, Shakira, Mariah Carey, will.i.am, Sting, Faith Hill, Maroon 5, and I joined Stevie Wonder on stage to sing Signed, Sealed, Delivered, I'm Yours, as the first couple in the entire audience danced along. As the year got underway, my connection to Swiss continued to surprise me. We seemed like such opposites, both artistically and personally. He'd often show up at the studio hours after the start of his session, and then work only a short time before heading out to a dinner, a gallery, a this, a that. He allowed the energy to guide him rather than the other way around. If the spirit was moving, he stayed with it. If it wasn't, he left and returned. My style was so different. I grew up with the kind of focus and discipline and structure honed through strict classical training. I'd arrive in the studio with a plan of execution, and if the vibe wasn't there, I dug in, the way I once did at Campo for the Diary album. If I was an hour late to the studio, I freaked out, whereas Swiss would run 4 hours behind. He's a free spirit, a super dreamer with his head in another galaxy. That difference is part of what drew us together. And over time, his spontaneity loosened my rigidity, even as my sense of structure rubbed off on him. We also stood shoulder to shoulder as equals in the music industry. When we attended events together, I didn't need to introduce him to anyone or rush to be sure he felt acknowledged. I could just exhale and enjoy myself. Swiss is an established artist in his own right, already widely known and respected. Upon entering a room, people were immediately drawn to Swiss. His words and ideas, his vision, his vibration and charisma, they seemed to compel others as strongly as they'd enraptured me. In public, the buzz was no longer just about my arrival. It was about both of us. Two energetically equivalent lights burning side by side in separate but equal musical spheres. That sense of equality brought understanding. If Swiss told me he had to go on the road, my response was usually, "Of course you have to be away next week, and I'll have to be away the week after that." Neither of us was ever leaving the other behind, feeling guilty about the constant travel that comes with being in our positions. There was an ease and effortlessness in our relationship. It also felt intellectually stimulating. Swiss was always scanning for new ideas, keeping his eye on everything from internet blogs and podcasts to the Los Angeles Times and Cultured Magazine. On long Sunday afternoons, we'd get lost in hours of conversation on everything from the rise of the Black Panthers during the turbulence of the 60s to the masterworks of photographer Gordon Parks. At every turn, Swiss and I challenged each other, widening each other's perspectives. The year came with another ground shift, this one between Jeff and me. When he and I had met all those decades ago at the Police Athletic League in Harlem, I was 14 and still the brightest shade of green. He was an industry vet with a don't F with me demeanor. In many ways, it was a perfect pairing. His strong-mindedness balanced out my youth and vulnerability. He was outspoken when I didn't yet have the voice or courage to be. That formula worked well for a long time, and then I sprouted wings. I'd felt the push and pull between us even in the early days. When I launched Keep a Child Alive, Jeff supported the idea of helping impoverished families battling HIV, but he didn't think I should be the one to spearhead that effort. Stay in my lane, that's what he wanted me to do. In his view, musicians created songs, activists launched movements, and those two spaces didn't need to overlap. Why dilute the artist's core brand? "Your music is what makes you most relevant," he'd tell me. "Focus on that." Jeff hadn't changed. He'd always been forthright. I was the one who'd outgrown our dynamic. While I respected his viewpoint, I didn't agree with it. Activism flows through my veins as strongly as artistry does. That mix is who I am. And the more I rallied for the important causes of our world, the less tolerance I had for any pushback. My involvement in social justice doesn't downplay my musicianship, it enhances it. At every turn, Jeff had been my greatest advocate, protecting me in an industry known for its mafia-like culture behind the scenes. But once you finally take sail in your life, you no longer crave a captain. You simply want a consultant, someone who can advise rather than steer. At 14, I was still too young and afraid to trust myself to direct my own course. At 28, I was finally becoming brave. And as I grew more courageous, Jeff and I grew apart. But even with my newfound strength and clarity, it was scary to move away from someone I depended upon for so long. Was I fearless enough to depend on myself? I now see transitions for what they are, the dawn of a new chapter. As miraculous as beginnings can be, they can also be excruciating. My new space with Jeff was preparing the way for all the heart-opening experiences still to come. As the curtain fell on 2009, I celebrated a highlight. The Element of Freedom became my first album to reach number one in the United Kingdom, even as it claimed the number two spot on the US charts. It went on to be certified platinum and sold more than 4 million copies worldwide. The single Unthinkable, I'm Ready, rocked into the top spot on the R&B charts and stayed there for 12 consecutive weeks, making it the longest-running single of that year and beating the previous 10-week record set by No One in 2007. And yet, with all the awesome moments the year brought for me, I look at the cover of The Element of Freedom and notice that my eyes are lowered, my spirit heavy. Even the album's title says a lot about the state I was in. For many years, I've understood the power of words, and when I titled the album, I thought the phrase was super empowering. It's not. The word element suggests one small piece of freedom, a single morsel, rather than the full experience. Both the title and the image reflect how that time was for me. I definitely wanted freedom, but I wasn't yet ready to step into it, embody it, breathe it, own it. You can hear those growing pains in the mood and lyrics of Element. The album has a somber sound. Element turned out to be one of my biggest albums, particularly because it included my version of Empire. But vibrationally, the image on the album's cover is my most muted. That had everything to do with the transitions I'd been navigating. Those tough passageways came with a surprising revelation. When life forces you to face yourself, what awaits in the mirror is a gift. Vulnerability. Your heart is pierced. You're broken open. You're hyper aware of what you're feeling. The song Unthinkable, I'm Ready, is an expression of that kind of rawness. I wrote it with Drake, who was then just starting out in his career. The flow was a conversation with myself.
I was wondering, maybe, could I make you my baby? If we do the unthinkable, would it make us look crazy? Or would it be so beautiful? Either way, I'm saying, if you ask me, I'm ready.
The song resonated with so many because it came from a genuine place. The lyrics were a statement, not to the world, but to myself. I can show weakness. I can be real. And when I reveal my true heart, not everyone is going to approve. What I know now is that I don't need them to. Chapter 12, Corsica.
Hello, this is Kasim Dean, a.k.a. Swiss Beats. Alicia and I was in the south of France, hanging out with our friends Desi and Katia. I woke up early and said to Desi, "Bro, I'm doing it today." He was like, "You're doing what?" I said, "I'm getting engaged." I hadn't planned it. I just felt it was the right time because Alicia and I were so head over heels. While she was still sleeping, Desi and I rolled out and got a 2-carat ring, one I could use that day until I had another one designed later. That afternoon, we went on a boat ride. While Alicia was out swimming, I began orchestrating the moment, where I'd stand, where Desi could position himself to capture the surprise on camera, how he can get the mountains in the background. That's the Virgo in me, precise. I finally went out on the deck, got on one knee and said, "Will you be my wife?" She was bugging out. In fact, she was so shocked that she dropped to her knees. I'm like, "No, stand up. I'm the one supposed to be kneeling." After she said yes, I slid the ring on her finger. For years, she wouldn't take that ring off, even after I presented her with the upgrade. Come to find out, she actually loved that damn ring and never wanted to trade up. That's Alicia for you. Less is more.
Swiss has never been an early riser, so when he woke me up with a peck on the lips at 8:45 a.m. on a Sunday while we were on vacation, that should have been a flashing red siren that something was up. "I've got to go out for a bit," he said. He was fully dressed. I, wrapped in a tumble of white sheets, slid open my eyes and glanced around the dark room. The night before, we'd pulled down the shade so the Mediterranean sun couldn't disrupt our plan to sleep in. "Where are you going?" I murmured. "Just running an errand," he said. I nodded, pulled the duvet over my head, and drifted back to sleep. Swiss and I were on a getaway to Saint-Tropez. Every morning,